Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we are discussing the Safdie Brothers crime thriller Good Time, as well as having an interview from one of the directors themselves, Josh Safdie. I'm Sam Howlett, and this week I'm joined by Ryan Hewitt.
Hello.
Hello. What have you been up to?
Well, this week I've watched a new documentary called The Work, which is by two guys called Jarius McCleary and Gethin Aldous. It is getting a lot of buzz on the festival circuit, mm-hmm. and quite rightly, it is absolutely fantastic, this documentary. It's about a rehabilitation program that's been set up in Folsom Prison for maximum security offenders, and they get taken through a psychological process to try and work out the root cause of their crimes, why they did what they did, and it throws up some extraordinary moments of guys just realizing that all their problems started when they were children, typically. It was a lot to do with their fathers and their relationship with their fathers. It's really brutal stuff. It's violently emotional. But all of the guys, all of the characters are so eloquent. Mm. They're in such a safe area that they are completely honest. They don't hesitate in what they're saying. It's sort of so open, and it just flows from them, and it is startling how raw and how candid they are with each other.
Okay.
And these are tough people. Yeah. These are people brought up with a strict code, like criminal code of honor, and there are murderers and assaulters and bank robbers, and they openly, you know, cry and get emotional and talk about the relationships with their parents and help each other. And it's a level of intense emotional connection that most of us probably don't experience in our life. And we're seeing it being experienced by a group of people who are the last people you think would be able to talk to each other this way.
And do you kind of like them in a weird way?
You endear to a lot of the characters because they're so self-aware and deprecating, and you don't really engage with what they did.
Right, okay.
It does get acknowledged for almost everybody. A lot of people are gang members, and you can make assumptions about what they are in there for. But it doesn't judge any of them. And the whole point of the process is about not judging each other.
Yeah.
And there's a card at the end that explains that this process, it's called The Work, and it is because it is hard work. Yeah. It's brutalizing what they put themselves through. And it supposedly led to early release for a number of people who've gone through it. It's effective.
Okay.
It's probably fairly controversial because it's tough. It's tough, and maybe it also has some damage in other ways.
Right.
But it's a fantastic documentary. I could not recommend it more. A little bit of a plug for BBC iPlayer. It's currently on there to watch for free as part of the Storyville strand. And I think you're going to hear a lot more about it in the coming awards season.
Yeah, so it's a film, like a feature film.
It's a feature-length documentary, but it has been picked up by Storyville, as they tend to pick out some brilliant documentaries in that strand.
Okay, excellent. On a slightly similar level, I've been watching Mindhunter on Netflix.
This
sort of blends fiction and non-fiction about how the FBI in the 70s started to use psychological behavioural studies to catch serial killers. Yeah. And like the highlight for me is what they do with Ed Kempler. So Ed Kempler is a real-life serial killer, the co-ed killer. I won't tell you what he did. But if you want to know, you can look it up.
Okay.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
But he's one of their subjects that they interview, these two FBI guys. And the FBI guys are, they're fictional characters, but he's real. And they interview him, and they like him. They really like him. They get along with him. He's funny. He's nice. He offers them sandwiches in prison. He gets stuff for them. But he like very casually talks about what he did to his victims.
In a kind of frank way.
And it makes so much sense to him. But this is the new Netflix show by David Fincher. So there's a high level of sort of prestige already built into it. And it took me a few episodes to fully get on board with it, but I am very much involved in it now. And it's kind of, it's got a kind of Silence of the Lambs vibe to it about FBI and psychology. And I went to see Silence of the Lambs actually when it was re-released a few weeks ago.
The part of the BFI 3 season.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, watching that and then watching Mindhunter as well was really kind of a nice blend of things going on.
So is Fincher directing?
He directed the first one. I think he directed the first two as well. But interestingly, an episode I watched the other day saw it directed by Asif Kapadia.
Oh,
the
wow.
documentary maker of Amy and Senna. So that was really interesting that they brought in this documentary maker. Really interesting choice, but...
I imagine, with it being true life and based on presumably transcripts, that he's got a sort of an affinity for representing that kind of thing.
And that kind of research that he did for those other films, that he can bring that to this. So yeah, Mindhunter, really, really worth a watch. Check it out. I mean, I don't think it's a very good title, to be honest. Mindhunter, it sounds a bit like a kind of Mindhorn spin-off.
Yeah, there's a sort of inbuilt irony in it, isn't there? Yeah.
But no, it's really good, really worth checking out. Okay, so before we discuss Good Time, let's hear from the film's co-director. So this is Josh Safdie, directs alongside his brother Ben Safdie, who had made a film...
This is their fourth feature, we're counting their first feature, which not everybody does.
Yeah.
But before this, they made Heaven Knows What in 2014, which is extremely tough, brutalizing, but completely electric and completely thrilling story about a heroin addict who lives on the streets of New York. It's based on a unpublished memoir of that person who also played the lead role.
Yep.
And it's drawn comparisons to, quite rightly, to like Christiane F. and Requiem for a Dream. Okay. And it's a completely uncompromising look at a street-level heroin addict's life and the constant search for the next fix and the relationships that form on the streets, like romantic relationships and business relationships and things like that. There's a lot in common with the way that Good Time is shot, which we'll get onto. But before that, they had a couple of other films, The Pleasures of Being Robbed and Daddy Long Legs, which are nigh on impossible to see.
Oh, really?
Well, I can't find Daddy Long Legs anywhere, although it played in the festival circuits and surely it's somewhere in the world, it exists.
Yeah.
But Pleasures of Being Robbed was a project that they were commissioned to make a short film, I believe, for a luxury handbag brand.
Right.
And it spun into a feature film and they ended up having something on their hands and decided to release it festival circuit.
So, co-directors, Ben Safdie is in the film as Nick, but then his co-director brother, Josh Safdie, sat down with Jake a few weeks ago. So enjoy.
So we are delighted to welcome Josh Safdie onto the Curzon Film Podcast to talk about Good Time. So Josh, this film, primarily about two brothers, their antics in New York, minus all the robberies, was there a personal genesis for this story for you?
But because of the fraternal relationship?
Yeah.
It's funny, when we premiered the film at Cannes, that's like your first taste of how the public narrative will unfold, and a lot of the conversations were, you two are brothers, this film is about brothers, is there a personal, origin to this story? The short answer is we didn't even think about it as a film about brothers until we were in Cannes being asked that question, because it's just the way things are. Benny is an extension of me and I'm an extension of him in many regards. And in that space, yes, I think Good Time is very much about, you know, knowing, you know, I mean, it's very different because Connie's was estranged from his brother because of potentially things that he did when he was a kid, which is obviously not in the film, but it's a backstory. But I do think that Connie sees Nick as an extension of himself. And in that regards, there's a bit of shame and also a rejection of that shame. Like, there's nothing wrong with you. You are a unique, interesting, strong person. You know, you just need to be taught that through independence, and you can only get independence through experience. And, you know, I think that Benny and I do push each other in that regards. And, you know, our dad growing up used to always tell us we were partners in crime and all we have is each other, and these weird fatalistic emotional romantic ideas about brotherhood were definitely grafted onto us as a very early age.
And that as you say, fatalistic emotion, I think that's very much part of Connie's character. Mm-hmm. In that, like, he has so much passion and emotion, but that's,
he's an intense guy.
Yeah.
Connie's an intense guy who is the star of his own world, and he's independent. You know, he's an independent person in a world that basically has already counted him out, and he's, you know, I don't know, doing things his own way in an effort to kind of have this thing called freedom, which is not really a real, it's almost like at this point, freedom is like and especially in America, it's like this strange concept of this thing that you're promised and this thing that you are kind of inherit, you're born with because you're American. But the reality is there's very little freedom.
He says at one point that in his former life, he would have been a dog.
Yeah.
I think that's very true.
I think so too. Yeah. I feel that way very much.
And so building that such an intense character, how did you do that with Robert? When did he come into kind of develop that with you?
Early on, I mean, when I first met with him, I noticed a mania inside of him, a determination that he wants to do something and he's not going to stop until he gets it. And also this kind of trauma inside of him. You know, obviously it's obnoxious to people with, you know, more intense traumas, but trauma is trauma. And, you know, I think being part of, you know, the worldwide phenomena that he was a part of in Twilight, I think that was very traumatic for him, the public part of it. I don't think the actual filmmaking part was traumatic, but, you know, the way the world was obsessed with him and he just constantly wanted to be on the run and hiding. So we wanted to bring those elements of his personality to the character, you know, as a man on the run. And we wanted to kind of create this illusion that he was street cast, you know, he was a real guy who we found and decided to put in a movie. And to do that, in order to do that, we had to basically sculpt the real life of a fictitious character. And that was based on real people, my personal stories and imagination and news stories, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, I think that the first thing that we kind of started to really realize was that he's kind of like a superhero in his own mind. There's an arrogance to his confidence. And he could, you know, I shared with him early on this documentary by John Alpert called 1 Year in a Life of Crime, and, you know, which followed around these kind of low-end criminals in Newark, New Jersey in the late 80s. And there was the thing that jumped out to Rob was that these guys were like superstars of their own films, you know, that they were very romantic. They're like, you know, have a small court date and they decide to jump it and they say, you know what, they're going to have to find me. This is this again, this like kind of romantic idea that's kind of born out of the movies. It's not really born out of real life. And I think that Connie is very much like a 2017, you know,
he's almost living in the crime films that he's seen.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, that's a lot of people. I mean, to rob a bank in 2017 is not a fruitful endeavor. Like, you don't get a lot of money robbing a bank. You know, at most you're walking away with $3,000 at most, which is a lot, but it's not like what the movies make it out to be. In order to get out what movies make it out to be, you have to really rob a bank. Like, you have, but most bank robberies, which happen daily, multiple times a day, throughout every city, they're quiet, they're mundane, they're note passing, they're like the way they are in our movie. and they usually only yield a couple thousand dollars, and then you get people do get greedy, like Connie, and they try to get more, and that's when problems start to arise. It's interesting that these big institutions are okay with losing a little bit of money, but once you try to take a lot of money, then they start to make things difficult and potentially dangerous for everyone.
And so, as you said,
but he does. Like, yeah. I mean, I do think that anyone who robs a bank in 2017 is responding to decades and decades of pop culture creating the romantic ideal to rob a bank. I mean, robbing a bank is, you know, it's the most romantic way to commit a crime. You're sticking it to the man. You're literally robbing money from a business that deals with money, and it's loud, and it's, again, it's built into the movie world. You know, it's Bonnie and Clyde. It's Dog Day Afternoon. You know what I mean? There's a precedent, a pop culture precedent to robbing a bank.
And so you mentioned a couple of films there that may not like directly influence this, but I believe one of them before Good Time was Walkabout, Nicholas Roeg's film. Is that right?
Yeah, but only very briefly. There's the Walkabout reference in the movie is, I mean, we only really reference two movies in the film, and it's After Hours and Walkabout. But Walkabout, it's such a misleading thing to kind of mention, because it was Ronnie, my co-writer, and who's the co-editor of the film, Ronnie Bronstein. He mentioned Walkabout in regards to a police montage in Good Time. He said, I think that we should do a police montage in the vein of a Nick Roeg montage. And he mentioned the scientist montage from Walkabout, and just that it's very quick and almost feels arbitrary. But that's it, really. I mean, it's not really... That's why I'm saying it's like to think that the movie was influenced by it. It's very formal influence, kind of. Yeah. And then After Hours, we literally referenced the soundtrack at one point.
Went on... I think in America, you guys went into the Criterion closet and picked out a few things. Your brother mentioned that he watched Mean Time. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much that influenced this film, but...
Very much some huge influence, Mean Time, yeah.
Yeah. Because the thing that struck me about what he said was that he watched Mean Time on YouTube. Because this film's going to come out in the UK on day and date. So
yeah, I heard that. Yeah, I just heard that yesterday.
So I was wondering if you were conscious or like cared about how people are going to be watching Good Time.
Look, I'm a romantic, I believe. I'm a romantic who, like, by design, has made my life unbelievably... tumultuous and busy. I believe that if you stop moving, you get depressed, and because it gives you time to think. So I just have inundate myself with so much stuff to do that when I go to the only way I can watch movies is in a movie theater. So I strongly hold on to and cherish the movie going experience, because it is an excuse to kind of be unbothered. You're in a movie, don't bother me, you turn your phone off. It's one of the few times in life where we turn our phones off, and most people don't even do that. So, I mean, but I don't turn my phone off all the time, but I don't check it, that's for sure. So I believe in that process. I believe in going to watch a movie. But yeah, Benny was referencing the fact, because that was the only way you could see it. It's actually very hard to even program those early Mike Leigh films, because they are so inundated with TV deals. Like, we've been trying, same thing with Alan Clark. We've been trying to program Made in Britain, you know, one of my favorite movies of all time. But you just can't screen it in a movie theater because there's a TV deal. The same thing with Executioner's Song by the Norman Mailer... Larry Schiller film. It's a TV movie, so it can't play in a theater. But I don't care the way people watch it. I think what's crazy, what filmmakers forget, is that in the lifespan of a movie, the theatrical experience is only 10% of viewers. Like, the movie goes on and lives on video, and that's how most people discover it. You know, if you're lucky, that's why theatrical experience is so special, is because you're lucky to see it. And that's what I think everyone needs to be reminded. Like, I know right now in the States, Good Time is on 35mm, and it's playing at the theater in New York, and it'll go to a theater in LA. And, you know, I know that I always feel very fortunate to see a movie on the big screen, and I see a lot. But, you know, it is important to remember, like, some of my most memorable film watching experiences have been on a cell phone. You know, when I was making Heaven Knows What, I watched an entire movie on a cell phone with the lead actress on the street, you know, and that was very memorable because it was, didn't matter where we were, the whole world disappeared and we were engaged in this little movie experience. That said, I still strongly believe in the theatrical experience, and, you know, I'd much rather see a movie in a theater than on a cell phone, but, you know, to each his own.
So I'm curious to ask you about the filmmaking process, because in your previous work, there's been a lot of blurring between when you are rolling and when you might not be, like even going down to the crew, maybe not being sure about what's being used, what's not. For something like this, that you're working with bigger set pieces, did you still try and maintain that fly on the wall feeling?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we, you know, making a movie is really just, it's like, I said this like in on Charlie Rose's show. I just kind of just said it, and I didn't realize that I never even thought of it before. It's really, you know, it's like, I don't know if you have the same thing here in London, but the express train and the local train, do they ride on parallel tracks?
Well, there'll be quite a few different trains, but
well,
yeah,
do you,
yeah,
like have... where you can be on one train and then you, the other train kind of pulls up and for a brief moment you can see into the other train and then it takes off, the express keeps going. Filmmaking is the local train catching up with the express train and then looking into it and just seeing a moment and then it takes off. And that's, you know, sometimes you want to maintain that as much as possible. And as this, the budgets get bigger and the crew sizes get larger, you know, it becomes harder and harder to kind of maintain that spontaneity. But we just did a big video shoot, and you know, even our DP, who's done $100 million films, you know, was still kind of like, wow, this is, you can make a movie like this. So, yeah, I think that, you know, you want to, I don't say action because I think that's, I feel awkward saying it in 2017. It sounds like you're referencing hundreds of millions of things. So we just kind of like set up the action and then I just wait and then we just start rolling when we're ready, kind of. So you can't, some actors need prompts, but I just have a hard time saying the word action. I don't know why. It seems corny.
Brilliant. Well, Josh Sefty, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
Okay, Josh Sefty there talking to Jake. So let's get into the film. I want to talk about the opening shot first, actually. So you start with this wide shot that feels really familiar of New York. It's this huge skyscraper, huge, like, cluster of skyscrapers, and it's sort of slow zooming into the building. It's kind of like the first shot of The Dark Knight, where it's zooming into that building. But that's kind of all we see of the New York that we think we know, like these huge skyscrapers and this busy, bustling urban environment.
Yeah.
Because then it goes directly down to street level, doesn't it, for the entirety rest of the film?
Pretty much the rest of it, apart from at the end when we go back to a high rise.
Yeah.
But it's a very unusual high rise.
Yeah.
It's not a typical New York
high
rise.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is a New York that I think, that has gone away, I think, for a while.
Certainly on film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's nice to be back in this kind of gritty 70s style ground level New York.
Yeah, absolutely. It's dirty, it's dangerous, it's that version of New York that certainly our generation hear about.
Yeah.
But if we go to New York, we're not going to see it.
Yeah, I went to New York and it couldn't have been safer.
yeah, you couldn't feel safer. Well, certainly in Manhattan
now. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
It's like the cleanest,
in a sense,
place that you could go, and everything feels so familiar because you've seen it on film and you feel like you know where you are.
Exactly,
everywhere you go, even if it's the first time you've been there.
Yeah.
But of course, this is set in Queens, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is a borough I've never been
to. Me neither.
I don't really know if this is a true representation of Queens. I imagine it's certainly an extra gritty version of Queens.
Slightly heightened sense of grittiness. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's where the thrill comes from this, right? That's where the stakes are, this depiction of a New York underworld, underbelly.
Yeah.
That is, it's just separate from a normal tourist or an outsider's view of New York. So everything that happens there has a slight detachment. And I think that allows us to enjoy what...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Is essentially quite a series of unpleasant events.
Yeah.
And not feel that it's, like, you know, like a dangerous, necessarily a dangerous world. It's that we're outsiders looking in on this low life.
Yeah, and there's almost this kind of slight sort of fantastical element to it as well, that it's this like other world. A world that we don't really know about.
Yeah.
That we're looking into.
Yeah, and quite a lawless world.
Yeah.
Within, we can see the police and we can see hospitals and authority figures and security guards.
Yeah. Yeah,
these kind of authority figures pop up, the kind of people that keep us in line.
Yeah.
But the characters in this film play by their own rules. They're outlaws. And it's not necessarily working out for them.
No.
Living this lifestyle. Largely because their circumstances, they're like low on the socioeconomic ladder and they're struggling to make ends meet anyway.
Yeah.
And they're just doing everything they can. And Connie, played by Robert Pattinson, is such a perfect representation of that, because he's got this amazing sort of like salesman patter.
Yeah.
Where in another life, he has all of the personal skills he would need to be an enormous success.
Yeah.
He's got the talk, he's got the charm, he's got the looks, he's got
the
swagger, the drive. If he wasn't from the background that he is from, or didn't feel the kind of allegiance that he does to his brother, this guy would be a high flyer.
Yeah.
But he is, for various reasons, living in this underbelly and doing everything he can to get the best out of it.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to determine if he is in this world because he likes it. Like, there's certain characters in the film that you think they really love this criminal life. This is for them.
Yeah.
But Connie is kind of, you can never tell if it's for a reason, if there's a specific reason he needs to get this and get out of this life, or if he kind of does enjoy it.
If he gets a thrill out of it,
if he thinks this is for me, this is the life I want to live, or it's hard, the film doesn't really place him on either end of that, I think.
No, it doesn't. And I think on the flip side of his talents in like persuasion, there is a dark side to that. There is this, is he a bit of a sociopath side? Like he's a user of people and a manipulator. And it does seem that the only person that he's really looking out for is his brother, which is a very like heartwarming connection he has with his brother. But outside of that, he's ruthless.
He is completely. And I think in that sense, he reminds me a bit of Sonny from Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah.
In that he is a criminal, very publicly doing a criminal act. He's not particularly sympathetic to other people apart from one person in his life, which is what he's doing everything for.
Yeah. But the only person he cares about.
Yeah. But at what cost? At the cost of a lot of other people.
Yeah.
A lot of other lives.
Yeah.
And that's that he's a real, you know, an amoral character, I think, Connie. You don't know whether you can fully trust him as a character as well.
I think you're right. I think Dog Day Afternoon is a good comparison as well, not only for the hinges on the aftermath of a bank robbery,
right?
But like you're saying, that vision of New York, that kind of character, kind of relationship.
Yeah. You were saying earlier about the sort of the film's influences. I mean, so Dog Day Afternoon is one of them. Like, what else did you pick out from this?
Well, should we say what the film's about? Like the
plot
of the
film? We haven't even said what the film's about yet.
Because then the influences kind of feed into that. So
so we have two brothers, Connie Nickus, played by Robert Pattinson, and then Nick Nickus, played by Ben Safdie, the co-director. And after a bank robbery goes wrong, Ben ends up on Rikers Island in custody with the police. And then Connie
has a certain amount of time, he feels, to bail him out and get some money to get him out, which is essentially it. And the film is him running around trying to find some money.
Yeah.
Whatever means necessary.
Yeah, and it's a complete, like, chaotic journey.
Yeah, it's sort of manic and constantly running, constantly on the move, doing something, yeah.
And things going wrong at every turn, desperately trying to get his brother out of jail, where he's particularly vulnerable in jail. So I think one of the key influences is not necessarily a film. It's, well, although there is a film adaptation, but it's a literary influence of Hubert Selby Jr. in that it is a very sort of fetishized version of the New York lowlife. And in particular, his novel, The Last Exit to Brooklyn, in which, I mean, Good Time could almost be a chapter of Last Exit to Brooklyn. Connie is the kind of character who would have been portrayed in Last Exit to Brooklyn, and you would have this kind of motivation and these same kind of conflicts. Mm-hmm. The film goes to some fairly dangerous places. I think it crosses a line of taste, moral taste, on two occasions, in a way that it gets away with it because of things we've been saying about how it's just slightly detached from reality anyway. It's depicting a world that isn't the common man's world. So it gets around those kind of problems. But it definitely flirts with moral quandary. And I think that Last Exit to Brooklyn is a really strong influence. And, you know, Jennifer Jason Leigh plays a role in Good Time and played Tra-La-La in...
Right.
Udi Adel's adaptation of Last Exit to Brooklyn. I think it's possibly, dare I say, an influence that they're wearing on their sleeve, like you said.
Yeah.
I also think that there's some influences from Cassavetti. I don't think that Cassavetti, were he making films today, would structure a film around the kinds of things that these two make films. I don't think he'd make a film about heroin addicts, about bank robbers. But I do think that he would nod to those facts of life.
Right.
I think he would make films in a New York street about these kinds of people, about the way they interact with each other, about the romantic and familial loyalty that comes out of them.
Yeah. Okay.
A film like, I mean, Cassavetti's like most commercial film, arguably, Gloria.
Yeah.
There's a few little elements of that. There's the New York, gritty New York vision. There's this one character who's very savvy and knows how the world works, looking after, in Gloria, a child, but in Good Time, he's looking after his brother, who is, he has some developmental issues, so he is vulnerable and he needs looking after. And, you know, there's a few little comparisons I could draw, little bit of a stretch perhaps, but I think that there's something about that energy. Even, frankly, the way the guys make, the way the Safety brothers make their films, they don't have permits for everything they do. They do
it's
things that they shouldn't
low
be doing.
Level,
it's this like guerrilla style of filmmaking that Cassavetti pioneered.
Okay.
And I've certainly heard them mention him as a strong influence.
Okay. Because I another comparison I got was The Warriors.
Yeah.
From the 70s again. Yeah. This kind of a side of New York that nowadays is completely alien to us, but at the time was a very real, dangerous place, I suppose. And in The Warriors, they have... It's all set over one night. They have to get from one place to the other and survive. And that's kind of what's happening here in a way. This kind of constant ticking of the clock, the constant moving on, the constant fear. You don't know who's around what corner.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? Who can we trust?
Yeah, and that sort of episodic approach to the story as well.
Yeah.
Little incidents happening.
And The Warriors as well has this kind of, this sort of... It feels just one remove from reality. Like, it's not like...
Yeah.
There's not fantasy elements in it, but it doesn't feel like our world all the time. And I kind of got that with Good Time here and there, that this doesn't feel completely hardcore realism, you know? There's a slight remove, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's hyper-real, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about Robert Pattinson in the film then. And the interesting thing about him and his career is that his diehard biggest fans that love him in Harry Potter and Twilight may not know about this film. So his career path is definitely one that you sort of can't look away from.
Yeah.
And the choices he's making at the moment with like Cosmopolis and this, it's just
one weird
thing after another.
He's doing a full rebrand.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, Supposedly, he approached the Safdie brothers and said he wanted to disappear into the role.
Right, okay.
He wants to be unrecognisable. He wanted people to watch this and say, isn't Robert Pattinson supposed to be in this?
Okay.
And not realise that that's who they're looking at.
Yeah.
And certainly the way they dress him in these, like...
baggy...
Avirex kind of jacket. This baggy leather jacket or pleather, whatever it is. And beanies and this trashy job of bleach blonding his hair.
Yeah.
He is... He's unrecognizable in several senses.
Yeah.
In, like, physically, he takes on a completely different form.
Yeah.
And the way he carries himself, the way he speaks, it feels very authentic, and he really feels like he embodies it. But the kind of character he's playing is unrecognizable to Robert Pattinson's previous work.
Yeah. And they also, I think it'd be very easy for a film like this to have its protagonist be a Robin Hood character.
Yeah,
that he's kind of he's a criminal, but he's doing it for a good cause, and especially he's doing everything to help his, you know, his vulnerable brother.
Mm.
But they throw some things in here and there that really are make him quite unlikable, and could make him quite unlikable.
Yeah,
some really, like you were saying about the kind of moral quandaries that it puts him in, and he kind of dives for everything. Like, he's not hesitant when he does certain things.
Yeah,
that you think, oh, that's... is that pushing his character too far? But I think they want that to do that. They want you to not be fully on board with Connie.
Yeah, you need to question everything he does. Partly because then you understand how much he cares about his brother.
Yeah.
But partly it's a character piece of character development, right?
Yeah.
It's showing you that this guy has lived in a world that requires him to be amoral and requires him to be ruthless. And it just fleshes out his past.
Yeah. But there's also the question of how good is he for his brother, because the opening scene has his brother in some kind of sort of facility.
He's I don't know exactly,
they don't really explain it, but
he's going through some sort of assessments to see how he's progressing,
and then Connie bursts in and says, no, I'm taking my brother with me, and then the guy says, oh, this is not good for your brother, and then his brother helps him rob a bank.
Yeah.
Next scene. So you do question, well, how much is this for his brother, or how much is it just because he, Connie needs Ben, maybe even more than, not Ben, Nick needs Connie.
Yeah, he's got... there's a codependency between them, isn't there?
Yeah.
Because they've seemingly abandoned their, like, parental figures,
their grandmother.
Yeah. And so there's very much this idea of it's us against the world. We've only got each other to rely on. And how much of that has been a choice and how much of it has been forced upon them is unclear. And with Connie, like you say, there's an element of doubt about him, about whether he is...
What are his reasons?
Which makes him complex and interesting.
Absolutely.
And fun to watch.
He is, you can't look away, can you? You can't
stay right
off him.
Yeah.
He's also kind of twitchy as well at times, isn't he? And just kind of weird. And
he's got this nervous energy.
Completely.
And, you know, it dives into the world of, like, street drugs.
Yeah.
And a big plot motivation is he's trying to find a bottle of Sprite that has been replaced. The Sprite's gone and it's full of LSD, it's full of acid. And it's been hidden somewhere, and he knows that it's worth a substantial amount of money and could be the key to bailing his brother out. So he's trying to track down this bottle of Sprite, and it's completely non-judgmental about this kind of recreational activity or what lifestyle choices. And he's definitely got that kind of drug-addled energy about
him. I need this fix. Yeah.
Yeah.
The scene where they introduced the bottle, I think, at first I was really like, what is going on? Because it's a guy telling a story.
And I was thinking, it goes into a flashback,
doesn't
it?
They've put a lot of time and effort into this flashback that I have no idea what this means to the plot at all. Is this just like a sort of flight of fantasy moment?
Yeah,
it's almost dare I say, kind of Guy Ritchie-esque, that moment
where
sort of the lock stock way of, like, right, here's what happened, and then he did this, and he did that, he did this, and he did that. Like, you know, it's that.
Yeah, it's exactly right.
Kind of moment.
Yeah, because it's not entirely, like, linear or coherent. It's just like little bits and pieces of what happened.
What this guy can remember.
I got out of prison, and then I was in the back of this cab, and I got thrown out. And that's Buddy Duress plays that character, and he is. He's obviously going to become, like, the Safdie staple.
Right. Has he been in
one of the main characters in Heaven Knows What, playing a similar kind of guy? It could be the same guy, I suppose.
Okay.
Again, like a low-level hustler and drug dealer and heaven knows what. And here he's just getting out of prison for something or other.
Yeah.
Fairly comfortable in that okay. world. And Buddy Duress is a real great, like, one of those faces that is a strange but captivating face.
Right, okay.
And his delivery of his dialogue has got so much character in it, especially when he tells that story, which is essentially like just a big piece of exposition in the back of a car.
It is, yeah.
But it's done in quite a dynamic way. And
it gets away with it.
Yeah.
And then Barkhad Abdi comes into it in a kind of small role, but he has quite a moment that you just think, oh no, don't do it, oh no.
Yeah.
Did you... Because I felt, in terms of the tone, I felt like every moment was kind of one step away from being full-on comedy at times.
Oh, it's very funny.
Yeah.
The without giving away any spoilers, the way that Buddy Duress's character enters the story by like, happenstance is hilarious.
Yeah.
And it plays with this idea of you can almost see it coming, but...
Yeah.
Can't work out how this is going to help the story, so surely this isn't what's going to happen.
I mean, I thought I saw that coming, but then I thought, no, this film wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
That's because it's kind of like, this would happen in The Hangover.
Yeah.
You know? There's loads of things I think, this could just be The Hangover if it was done in a different way.
Yeah.
This plot point. But it manages, it's such a good balance, actually, of that tone.
Yeah.
To keep it not, to not go too broad with it.
Definitely, because it doesn't. Yeah, when it does deliver a punchline, which it delivers several punchlines, it's not like pause for a laugh. It doesn't have that tone to it.
Right. So the film has also got this really. Yeah, we've been talking about a lot of 70s movies here. And the soundtrack, I think, plays into that. And this is by 10Trix Point Never. And it's this very kind of John Carpenter-y synth electronic. Yeah. And it feels, I don't know if this is actually the case, but it feels like it never stops. It feels like the music plays from opening to end. Like there's always something, some music.
I think you're right. I think it's, I don't know if it does it come and go, but it does create such an atmosphere that is so in tune with the film's tone that it feels like you're in it the whole time.
Yeah.
And even if you can't, even if the soundtrack isn't playing there's this like low-level hum and it's got this sort of abrasive bass that runs through that just stays with you.
I think it's the kind of soundtrack that you want to like own on vinyl, you know, and put it up on the wall and show it off.
Yeah, I think so. And of course, it won Best Score at the Cannes Film Festival this year, Best Original Score.
Okay, excellent.
Thoroughly deserved. And it's in keeping with again something that the Safdie brothers did in Heaven Knows What.
Right, okay.
I don't think it was the same composer, but it, again, like very abrasive electronic sounds designed to disorientate. Yeah. And seems to be their style coming through. You know, their influences are abundant, without question, but they have got an energy that I think is quite unique.
Yeah.
And while I think that there's comparisons with things like Tangerine in that it had this pace and it was low level and it was people running around streets and chasing after something, and that had a great energy. But the Safdie Brothers stuff has a bit more grit and it has... Yeah. Something of its own. I think that they're not just copying people. They're doing something really unique. And I can't wait to see what they do next. We actually asked the Safdie brothers to pick some films for us to program a night of all-nighters.
Right.
Because Good Time takes place over a 24-hour period. Yeah. And so they've got a lot of influences on... there are lots of films that take place over 24 hours. And so we asked the Safdie brothers if they could choose... 6 films that you could watch all night, an all-nighter of all-nighters. So you'd start at 8 p.m. And then you'd finish at 8 a.m. And they started with Collateral, Michael Mann's film, Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx.
That, I can see that fitting in with this, actually.
Yeah, and that like neon-soaked night and amoral characters with a persuasion and charm.
And an A-list actor doing something different
as well. Yeah,
yeah.
And then at 10 p.m. you were to tune in to... After Hours, Martin Scorsese's film with Griffin Dunne, which is all over Good Time, I think. Certainly in the campaign, they've referenced it with the kind of style of the poster work in the States. At midnight, they went on to George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead.
Right.
Then 2 a.m., you'd go for Larry Pierce's The Incident.
Okay.
Which is a film I'd never heard of. No, it has Martin Sheen's first on-screen appearance.
Okay.
It's about a commuter train in New York that gets taken over by some punks.
Right.
This is made in the 60s, yeah. Where the biggest social threat to everyone was punks and hippies.
Yeah.
And they terrorize this carriage of train, of passengers. Then at 4 a.m. you'd watch Mike Leigh's Naked, which I think has great comparisons to Good Time, particularly in David Thewlis's character and his like nihilistic worldview and his wordsmanship. And finally you'd finish with this film called Miracle Mile, which I had never heard of. Okay. Just an absolutely bonkers film about everything going wrong for a guy in a day. And so, you know, they're very open about the things that have influenced them.
But they're not... It's not like a Edgar Wright film where they are.
Yeah.
They're not referencing anything, maybe. They're just... They've watched a lot of films and they're like anyone, they've just been influenced by these. And it's kind of obvious that they have been influenced, but they're not spoofing anything, are they? They're not... This is an homage to this, or we did this because we love this. It's just, we watch a lot of stuff and this is what happens when you watch things.
Like, yeah, I think that's right.
Speaks through you, yeah.
Yeah. I think that their references are more tonal, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
And it's more, like we've been saying about the particular depiction of New York being straight from the 70s.
Yeah.
And that's that kind of thing they're referencing.
Yeah.
Rather than
a specific
gags and little bits in other films.
Yeah. Any final thoughts then on the film?
Well, my final thought is a fairly bold one. I genuinely think that so far this year, this is probably my film of the year.
Okay.
I think it is utterly exhilarating.
Yeah.
It's daring.
Yeah.
It's a little bit, it makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable in places, but it owns them and it wins every one of those moments. I think Robert Pattinson is fantastic in it. I think the supporting cast are brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think the Safdies are one of the most exciting pairs at the moment.
It's definitely up there for me. And because it is so kind of unapologetically fun.
Yeah.
Yet also immoral.
Yeah.
And something that just a really good, sort of Friday night film, you know, you watch it really late, I think. Like 1 a.m. or something.
It's like a midnight movie. Isn't
it? Absolutely. Yeah. And it does have. Even though it's not even come out yet, but it already feels like it has this cult feeling to it, that it's going to have this admiration, a long life, I think.
I think so too. Yeah.
And the way we've got a piece of marketing with us over here, which is this kind of just sheet of fake LSD tabs with R. Patz's face in the middle.
Yeah.
Just so surreal. But stuff like that, I think this is just destined to be, a long-standing cult favourite.
Yeah.
That will have midnight screenings. You're right, yeah.
Yeah, I think it will. I think you're right.
But this Friday at Curzon Soho at 7:45, there is a Good Time event, is there not?
There is, yes. On Friday the 17th of November, as Sam says, at 7:45 at Curzon Soho, we're throwing a bit of a party to celebrate Good Time. We're going to be some DJs from Warp Records and Fonica Records are going to come along and play. Worth mentioning that the soundtrack we talked about by 10 Tricks Point Never is available through Warp Records, hence why they are providing a DJ. And there are going to be some themed cocktails, there's going to be some prize giveaways, and of course you can see the film.
Sprite bottles filled with acid?
Sprite bottles, yes. But filled with Sprite.
Excellent. So Good Time is out today on Friday the 17th, and it is also on Curzon Home Cinema as
Indeed it is.
So you can watch it at home or in the cinema, it's completely up to you. Okay, so that's the end of the show. All we've got time for there. Thank you very much for listening. But that's not the end of your podcast experience this week, as we'll also be doing a separate episode where me and Jake will be discussing Paul McGuigan's Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool and Matt Spicer's Ingrid Goes West, as well as having interviews from both of those directors. So do make sure you check that out. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you then.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.